Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
This awareness that we're cultivating in emotional sobriety, how can we describe it so that people can integrate it into their own recoveries and their own, you know, kind of emerging emotional freedom as we continue on this journey? What's the tenor of the awareness? How do we describe it for people?
The follow-up question needs to be, what specifically do we need to be aware of?
The first thing we got to do is understand the nature of awareness and consciousness and see what we're aware of and what we're conscious of is determined by our current level of development. It was clear in Piaget's studies when he looked at kids, like, let's say, what he called the pre-operational phase of thinking or stage of thinking, which was 2 to 7 years old. He tried to understand, well, what is the nature of that consciousness that a child has at that stage of their development? And what he saw was that it looked very different than as we mature. So a child at that stage, if you took two beakers that were the same size and had the same amount of fluid in it, and then you had a tall beaker next to it that was empty, and you first asked the child, hey, on these two beakers that have the same amount of fluid, are these the same or are they different? A child say they're the same. And then in front of the child, the examiner picks up one of the beakers, pours it into the now tall beaker, and of course, because it's tall and skinny, the water level is much higher. And now she asks the same question. Are these the same or are they different? The same amount of fluid was poured right from the glass. You saw that. But because of the nature of the child's cognitive development, the child says the tall one has more water in it. How did the child decide that? Well, the child used the height of the beaker as the most relevant factor in terms of making that decision. So the consciousness of the child could only focus on the size, not the amount of fluid in the beakers. You follow me? So that child, and if you said, no, they're the same, you couldn't convince that child. They can't see that because they are focused on that dimension of reality. Now, what that tells us is when our emotional development is arrested, when we are stuck at an earlier stage in our life, and that's why I describe our problems as not pathological, as developmental. When we're stuck at an earlier stage in our life, then we do the same thing with those beakers. When I am emotionally immature, I look at what I would call the least relevant aspects of reality. And what are those? I take everything personally. It's all about me, 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 me. And I see everything that's going on as a reflection of how people feel about me, what they think about me, whether I can feel good about myself based on how they feel about me. I mean, it is, my focus is all on those issues. As we mature or become more differentiated in our consciousness, the nature and character of what we focus on is very different. It's very different. And that's what we were talking about before, is that what I look at as I love this work that we've done, because, you know, one of the things that, Tom, you brought into this thing is try to have a reasonable doubt about what you're seeing, that it may not be what mm-hmm. you think. Right.
Be a healthy skeptic. Absolutely.
Right. I mean, we talk about that. Right. And I thought that concept is so important, because in that skepticism comes some curiosity. Hey, there may be another way of looking at this. I might be seeing this all wrong. I might be looking at this from a certain angle that I take it very personally. When, what if I just entertain the idea that it's not personal? See, even just a sliver of that healthy self-doubt. See, we're not talking about a neurotic self-doubt where I'm questioning myself and da, da, da. We're not talking about something that undermines your sense of self. We're talking about something that opens up a new possibility.
If the continuum is cynicism to just naivete, you know, is then eat, you're, those are really rigid positions in either one of those places. What we want is to be able to move, and skepticism, you know, can skeptic, and I like, I think we should put those three words together as often as we can. Skepticism and because often that has a negative connotation, but it's like, no, that's, you know, every scientist is a great skeptic. It's like, you know, I don't believe it just because, and it's like skepticism and flexibility in there is needs to be, you know, needs to be a part of the process. Absolutely.
Cynicism to naivete in the context of awareness. That's an interesting arc.
Try to convince a true cynic that they're rigid in their thinking. It's like, because they rigidly believe they're not.
When we're talking about a skepticism here, there's a difference between what would be an unhealthy skepticism and something that's healthy. See, something that's unhealthy would be based on anxiety. See, that skepticism that grows out of anxiety is going to be a skepticism that's designed to protect us from being disappointed, from being hurt.
No, you know what? It's and then again, I guess my job is to be oversimplistic today. But what you just made me think of is that the skepticism we're talking about here is head stuff. It's like the skepticism that is in us unconsciously because of our development is in our heart and our guts. It's like so the idea is, and this is where I'm often telling my clients, is like, look, I know therapists are always telling you to get into your gut, but sometimes we got to come back up to our head and do some thinking about what's going on here. And it's not like, I want you to feel all those feelings too, but it's like, we need to understand this. And that's kind of what you're saying when we start talking about the question, Alan, is let's understand what awareness is.
Well, a big step forward for me, just as a personal example, is depersonalizing romantic rejection. In high school, I had this pattern where I would just become infatuated with somebody and, you know, dote on them and then get rejected and then just feel like without a doubt, it was because I was lacking is the reason that, you know, my feelings weren't reciprocated. And, you know, it's followed me through my life. You know, I it's only recently that I've been able to, like, get out of bad relationships, you know, and I was able to make that decision because I am kind of getting my legs under me.
Toward or into freedom.
Yeah, I mean, towards it anyway, you know, away from, yeah. But I mean, like, those rejections I had in my teenage years, it was like, you know, God was rejecting me. Like, I there was never a, I never doubted, like, that the way I was defined by somebody else was just the way that I was.
Client in my office yesterday, a grown middle-aged woman who, that was the exact same, that's the issue she had, is if this person sees me as valuable, then I'm valuable. And it's like, you know, and again, until she examines it, it's, you know, that's just, she just is, as she understands it, that's the way it is. So that's where we use healthy skepticism.
See, the healthy skepticism comes out of, like you said, Tom, it's a response. It's not a reaction. When you're skeptical out of reacting to a situation, you're not thoughtful about it. You are reacting, like you said, from some kind of a trauma.
It's like it's a part of distrust.
Yes, that's it. The difference here is we're not talking about distrust. We're talking about a reasonable doubt. That's all. It's a different thing. Now, look, and reasonable doubt means we're just open. Like you said, if you take a scientist's attitude towards this, let me try to just look at this from a different way and see what it might look like from this perspective.
All right, right. And it even can go so far as, and I've been reading some stuff recently just about the power of imagination, just using imagination. And this fits into this very well. It's like, let me imagine I can see this thing from as many different angles as I possibly can. It's like, yeah, it just opens possibilities up.
I've been a fan of Byron Katie's work. I think that she's really got some great insights into some things. There's some areas where, that I think they, of things differently than her. But what I like is this inquiry she does with people. And it's exactly what you just said, Tom. What she says is, all right, so if you believe that that's true, right? Let's say that it is personal. Let's go back to your example, Patrick. Yeah, that person rejected you because of something, some inadequacy in your person. So if you believe that's true, what does that mean? What does that make you feel? What are the implications of that? And then she takes somebody into that whole thing. And then she says, so now if you let go of that idea that that's not true, what might that mean? So she does exactly what Tom is talking about. She uses the person's imagination.
Yeah, she uses the language of that too. She doesn't, we're not trying to talk anybody out of anything. We're just saying, consider this, you know,
If you look at it from this point of view, if this isn't true, then what does it mean? If what you believe in,
you're actually asking hypothetical questions.
Yes. Then she says, now what does that feel like? If you walked around in the world and you didn't take it personal, what would that be like? So she does exactly what Tom is doing, that she uses. And in Gestalt therapy, this is a part, we do this all the time. Like let's say I'm working with someone and I can sense that this person doesn't want to share something because they're ashamed of it. So once again, we respect it, right? I don't push somebody to do something they don't want to do. I respect the resistance, right? But what we might do is an exercise like this. I want you to close your eyes. I don't want you to share unless you want to share what's going on. But I want you to imagine that you've just told me what you are afraid of telling, what you're hesitant to tell me. And I want you to play out in your mind and tell me what you imagine would happen if you own this and describe it to me. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we take them with their imagination.
Imagination, absolutely.
The whole thing. And then it's always going to be a projection, right, of their anxiety. So I imagine you think less of me, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And you know, what the person eventually finds out is they're projecting their own, right, criticism of themselves, their own self-hate or whatever it is that's going on, their own values that they feel have been violated, and it just opens up some other possibilities. So you're right. Sometimes, Tom, just imagining what would happen if I didn't take this personally? What would that mean in our relationship? What would that tell me about the other person?
You know, and I often talk about just looking at using my therapy room in that way. I use a physical metaphor. It's like, let's imagine we're looking at it from that chair over there or this chair over there. It's like when you basically what we're trying to do, and it's definitely teaching somebody to farm rather than giving them, you know, food. It's like teaching them that basically this moving around and looking at things from different angles is really a productive way of problem solving, for one thing, which is what we're doing in therapy.
I have a friend I'll be seeing later today. He just had a new baby, and I haven't seen him since the baby was born. But in thinking about him this morning, it occurs to me he has a large dose of emotional sobriety and has for many years. And I think that what the stuff that we talk about week to week just makes more intuitive sense to some individuals. And they find their way to it intuitively. Whereas with me, with my kind of like, you know, development was arrested at some point. And that shift from environmental support to self-support has been something that I've really needed to bring the village in on. And really, it's taken a lot of like outside help to get there. I'm sure you guys have thought about it before, but like, you know, why does it make intuitive sense to some individuals more so than others?
general question that is development modeling what people have gotten. I mean, it's like, you know, the truth is, you know, I mean, there's sure exceptions to the rule, but you know, I grew up as a very reflexive, negative interpreter of the universe, because I grew up in that. I was surrounded by that in my world growing up. It's like I didn't think of it as negative. I thought of it as just perceiving. When we're not in a particular place, and that's part of that respect Alan's talking about that we need to have, is something may look obvious to us. It may be like glasses on my head and me saying I can't find my glasses, and you guys are going, idiot, he's right there on your head. But it's like, it's not like that for the person who has it. And it's like finding the hidden picture in Highlights magazine. You can't see it, you see it, and then you can't unsee it, which is both a blessing and a curse. It's like, and that, because that's what awareness, the cool thing about awareness is you really can't reverse it.
Setting the clock back to when I was 17, 18, and I was struggling with those feelings of unrequited love. I mean, that was when I started using, you know what I mean? And so I couldn't cultivate any sense of awareness unless I could get clear and get off all the drugs, or the drugs that I was on, the alcohol. So that's about 20 years. I had to, you know, get lost in the woods and then crawl out of the woods and then get properly started on.
At my book signing for the Self-Forgiveness Handbook, my wife was a part of that, and I can't remember why she did it, but she did this impersonation of my high school poetry, and it was like. I couldn't do it like she does it, but it was spot on. It's like, you have hurt me to the core. You have ruined my life. You know, I am going to die. You know, it's like, it's horrible. It's all these horrible things, you know, and it's like, it was just like that, because everything was not only personal, it was fucking deadly.
I like that you didn't use contractions. It's you have. You know, you have ruined my life.
One of the things I remember from the beginning when we did the first accidental workshop together is, and we've done every workshop like that since then, it's like, it's essentially, if you put us in a room and we're doing a workshop, we're going to have a conversation. And we're gonna compare notes. We're gonna have a conversation, and we're gonna teach each other things. We're gonna say, "Oh, I never thought about that way." You know, it's like, or wait a minute, you think, look at this, and it's like we bring people into that. And I hope what comes across is that our curiosity becomes contagious.
Let me just say this as we wrap up today's episode. See where this leads us as we mature, and as I mature, my consciousness is going to change. Remember that the child, after they're 7 years old, will look at those beakers, and when you pour it in, they'll say, it's the same, even though that other beaker's taller, right? Not going to focus on the height of the beaker. They're paying attention to what Piaget called the object constancy, the fact that the amount of fluid is constant regardless of what container and the size of the container that it's in, right? So that changes just developmentally. You can't tell a child to change that. It happens to them as a result of their maturation. And so oftentimes what we see is change is a byproduct of somebody changing their maturation. We don't have to tell them to look at a situation different. As they start to become more differentiated, they start looking at situations differently. So it's a very interesting thing, is that, you know, Herb will often say, Herb Kagan, when you go to his workshops, that this stuff just happens to me. Well, he's right in one sense, that you don't change your perception. It changes as a result of you changing. You see, it's a very interesting thing to stop and ponder. So the question becomes, well, how does our consciousness change as we become more mature and differentiated? You know, what does that look like? We'll talk more about that next week. But just a preview to that is that what happens is that you now develop what we can describe as an appropriate and honest relationship to reality. You know, it was funny, in my graduate program, we talked a lot about what's called ego strength. right? And ego strength had to do with how well a person was able to deal with reality. The more ego strength the person had, the more they could handle reality the way it was. The less ego strength they had, the more they got lost in their fantasies about reality. Which is so interesting, because this is where imagination is used in the unhealthy way, right?
Use your imagination for good, because it's being used all the time for negative. More to come.
More to come.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.